You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Congress went into recess at the end of last week, they left several important bills unfinished. Today, we have the first in a two-part series called Legislative Leftovers, and we will take a look at where the debate over the proposed trillion-dollar overhaul of health care stands. Joining me now are Ezra Klein, who writes about health care as part of his blog for The Washington Post called Economic and Domestic Policy and Lots of It, and Luke Mitchell, the senior editor for Harper's Magazine. His article on health care appeared in the magazine's February issue. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having us.
How are you doing?
White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was quoted as saying about health care, August has both peril and opportunity. Is that because the debate on health care is now centered more on public opinion than it was when Congress was in session, Ezra?
Yeah, I mean, it was an inside game for many, many months there, right? And so you can predict how an inside game is going to go with a fair bit more accuracy, right? Rahm Emanuel knows where the votes are. He knows who are the eight or the five senators who he needs to move. He knows sort of what the constraints of the debate are. But now, as you're watching these town halls, as we move into a much more grassroots-oriented discussion, things get a lot more complicated, a lot more uncertain. You could see a situation in which conservative and wavering senators become very scared to vote against health care reform. They don't want to be associated with these mobs, that there's a backlash against the town hall protesters and ratings go up, or you could see the opposite. So as he says, there's a lot of opportunity for people to come back and really decide they want to get something done, and then you're actually in a better spot than you were before you left. But there's also the opposite. I mean, health care reform could wither and die in August.
Well, Luke, some of the things we've been hearing about from these town halls relate to topics that you discussed in your article, but they don't seem to be relevant to the current debate.
That's right. In my Harper's article, I tried to talk about some of the stranger beliefs people have about what health care reform would mean, and it seems now that those beliefs are coming into play. In fact, I think the genius of the Republican move to push this forward and give them a month to create a new storyline is that this month they've been able to transform this debate about who gets what money to spend on what health care into a debate about ideological things, which is a much more comfortable territory for them. So it's not a debate about how to give people health care. It's a debate about euthanasia. It's a debate about abortion. It's a debate about death panels. And John Boehner, of all people, summed it up, I thought, when he said that he wanted it to be a long, hot August for Democrats in Congress.
Ezra, hasn't it been alleged that some of the most vocal opponents at these town halls have been sent by public relations firms?
You know, it has been alleged, and it may be possible. I think that people who want to take the approach that anybody who is in some way organized by a professional, you know, grassroots organization or an AstroTurf organization is somehow inauthentic is painting themselves into an unuseful corner. I mean, you know, I go on a lot of radio shows right now. I'm doing a lot of media on this. I get a lot of emails and calls to my desk. People, the level of emotion here is genuine. That's not to say it's not being channeled in some ways very effectively, in some ways very perniciously, by organizations that specialize in doing that very sort of thing.
And then egged on by Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and others.
Right. I mean, if you think that people listening to Glenn Beck tell you about death panels are in some way that their resulting fear and fury is inauthentic, I think you're barking up the wrong tree. What should be said, though, is that you're seeing actually very little discussion about health care reform and all this. What you're seeing is politics by another means. I mean, you're seeing the people at these meetings have been largely older, largely white, not that rich. I mean, a lot of people on Medicare or coming near to Medicare. You could really imagine a healthcare debate that was about the people who will be affected by this bill, which are mainly people with low incomes and people with very high incomes, because the primary thing these bills do is do a transfer from the high incomes to the low incomes. But you don't have 47 million uninsured people facing down 20, you know, 5 million hedge fund managers. What you have are instead people who are, in a very traditional sense, very politically involved. They listen to Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh. They're members of unions. And those are the people being turned out. This is much more like a campaign than it is an argument over a particular piece of policy.
Well, are opponents attacking the current bills in Congress, or are they attacking the idea of health care reform in general?
Well, I think Ezra raises a good point. This is a political campaign. Unfortunately, in dividing this into two sides, we've created a false dichotomy. There's no question of socialized medicine versus private competition, what we're talking about basically is bribing private insurance companies into allowing us to provide health care to poor people. And it looks like we're going to succeed in doing that because we're going to spend a lot of money to do it. But that's not what anyone's discussing.
Well, Matthew Dowd, the Republican political strategist, warns the GOP to be careful because if the legislation fails and they're seen as having blocked all reform, it will backfire on them. Do you agree, Ezra?
I don't. I'd be very surprised if that happened. I mean, I think that the Republicans are using a playbook from 1994 that actually worked, and that it's a very common playbook for minorities, right? People don't like Bill Kristol, the sort of the writer and the Republican strategist, because he said in 1994 and says now, kill the bill. Don't bargain. Don't give them half measures. Don't try to add your perspective into it. Just kill it. Make it die. That is how you win the next election. And people look at that and say, you know, he's a real bad guy. And he may be a bad guy. But he wasn't wrong. And it wasn't wrong for Democrats when they killed off privatization, which I think they should have done, and stymied the Republican agenda in 05 to win a massive majority in 06. I mean, the way that minorities have traditionally come back into power is by making a failure out of the majority. And they do that by using A, sort of public opinion, but B, also the particular rules of the Senate, which allow the minority to stymie the efforts of the majority. So I would be surprised. Matthew Dowd has made that point. David Frum, another sort of reformist Republican, has made that point. But I think that if I were a Republican strategist telling them what to do, and I feel bad saying this, you know, I would say, yeah, you got to kill this, because at the end of the day, this is not going to be a success associated with your party. And it's going to be hard to run against the Democrats when they're saying, you know, we just brought health care insurance to 40 million Americans.
It is interesting that the people who played Harry and Louise are making new commercials in which they are supporting health care reform. But health care opponents are outspending advocates 2-1 on getting the message out to citizens. So what's your take on it? Do you think somebody is winning this debate right now, this PR debate?
The insurance companies are winning the PR debate because what they have basically is Democrats working to pass a bill that they like and Republicans working to make sure that no one stops them from doing so. The entire range of debate right now is between we're going to give the private insurance companies a little bit of money and we're going to give the private insurance companies a lot of money. And going to Ezra's point about Republican activists, I think he's absolutely right. Bill Kristol raises a fine tactical point. But it is nonetheless morally despicable.
Sure.
And Republicans can wake up in the morning and decide that what their job is to do is to win elections, or they can wake up in the morning and decide what their job is to do is to help people. And it's clear what their choice has been thus far.
A poll conducted in 2007 revealed that 70% of Americans were in favor of health care reform then, even if it meant that their taxes had to go up a little bit. Why has that changed? Is it because of the recession, Ezra?
You know, you see this every time a major bill occurs, right? You see it is always the exact same path. The bill begins popular because if it wasn't popular, nobody would be focusing on this issue. And then, you know, for the early months of the legislative process, while they're talking about it and while they're building it and while they're thinking about it and while they're forming coalitions on it, it remains very popular. And people talk about how the other side is completely disorganized and how they're out of touch with public opinion. And then eventually you actually have a bill. And then the minority begins to gear up. The people who are afraid of the bill begin to gear up. The attacks of those who feel their incomes will be hurt are always much more vicious and aggressive and focused than the sort of diffuse support of those who will be helped. And, you know, it happened like this in 1994. It happened like this for Bush with privatization in 2005. And it's going to and it's happening this way now. There is simply no way that we have for any piece of legislation run by the majority to remain popular as it travels through the legislative process. But the one caveat to that, and I think this is important for Democrats to understand because I'm quite sure Republicans do understand it, the way people decide later on whether or not a bill was a good bill or not is in some ways whether or not it passed. Medicare Part D, by the time it went through, was actually pretty unpopular. But it passed, people began to explain why it was good again, and now it's a very popular bill. Conversely, the Clinton plan became a much more unpopular bill in retrospect than it was for most of its actual life in Congress.
It seems
that. So you do have a situation where if this dies, this bill will look, as people begin to explain why it failed, as as outlets like mine write a lot of stories showing all the backbiting in the Obama administration and the dissension between Democrats and arguing that it was liberal overreach, it will become a much more damaging piece of legislation than it ever would have been if it passed, despite the fact that nothing will change in the actual bill.
But it is interesting that people still want health care reform. A couple of weeks ago, a Time magazine poll found that 69% of Americans believe that it's important to pass a major health care reform bill in the next few months.
Right.
And to follow up on what you just said, Ezra, weren't the Republicans hurt in November because they didn't realize that the political landscape had changed?
Well, you know, they were dealing with an economic collapse. I mean, I think it's true that they were. The one thing I'll say is that in one of our very recent polls, you had this very startling, and this again is very common, this startling disconnect between people don't like Obama's bill. They actually had a plurality not supporting it at this point. But if you describe Barack Obama's bill, almost, I mean, not his bill, but the congressional bill that he's sort of behind, if you describe that bill almost precisely, and taxes will go up and this and that, heavy plurality support, or majority support, rather. So I think it was about 60%. So what is happening here is not that the idea of healthcare reform or even the specifics of healthcare reform are becoming unpopular, but the amount of controversy over the bill actually moving through Congress is making that bill unpopular. People have a very heavy status quo bias, and when it begins to get this complicated, they get afraid. It's not that they don't want action, but they're worried about this thing they're hearing with death panels and all the rest of it.
A listener who's a former U.S. history teacher called in to say that she's very frustrated that health care reform proponents are not refuting the inaccuracies and distortions that are being promulgated. How much misinformation is there out there?
There's a profound amount of disinformation out there. And in fact, I think a large reason for that is the sort of thinking that we see about the political conversation being separate from the actual policy conversation. Medicare Part D, that Ezra mentioned, is a terrific example. It may well be more popular than it used to be, but it's still a terrible piece of legislation that's costing people a fortune, that's needlessly making their pharmaceutical access complicated. Similarly, we have a lot of opinions about the political merits of the current bill in Congress, but the underlying policy merits of it aren't anywhere on the table. Again, this is a function of Republicans and insurance companies working together to create a distraction. I mean, it's a very old-fashioned ideological claim to say that the people are being distracted from pursuing what's in their interest, but in this case, it's pretty much an open and shut case.
You know, I don't think I totally agree with Luke on that. I think that there is a tendency to believe that the constraints on the healthcare discussion are entirely a function of both industry groups and special interests, and then on the other hand, minority obstruction. But one of the things that has been, I think, traditionally very problematic for reformers in here is just that it turns out that people have pretty bad opinions on healthcare, or at least very, very self-conflicted opinions, right? One of the really important things, whether you're a single-payer guy or a market guy, is that you'd want to take apart the employer-based healthcare system, that just about everything that's truly problematic here stems from that. But that is wildly unpopular. I mean, it's wildly unpopular, just political death up and down. And then, you know, another one of the things that people end up having trouble with is that one of the reasons that reformers right now are trying not to touch the insurance people have is that, in general, they like it. Now, you can say they like it because they don't have to use it, or you can say they don't really like it, or you can say that Medicare has higher satisfaction, which it does, but they fundamentally sort of like it, and they don't want it to be changed unless they're making that choice. And so a lot of the policy problems that we're seeing in the bill, and I don't think these are great bills, I just think they're about what you're able to get, actually come from constraints that politicians sense from public opinion, from the amount of fear people have about changing something as personal as healthcare, and from the amount of fundamental distrust they have about the government. I mean, one of the really interesting sub-themes of this whole argument has been what people are willing to believe the government wants to do. I mean, euthanasia, death panels. I mean, these are blue dog Democrats who got to get reelected in 2010. They're going to kill your grandmother? But there's at least a small core of people who will believe just about anything about the government, and then a larger group who are just sort of fundamentally skeptical that the government is going to get this right, particularly when there's going to be this much controversy around it. So I don't think it's all of the problems here are a function of industry on the one hand and Republicans on the other, that, you know, reformers have had to create a pretty complicated bill because they're trying to tiptoe around public opinion.
We have to take a little break. We'll come back to that. My guests are Ezra Klein, who writes the Economic and Domestic Policy and Lots of It blog for The Washington Post, and Luke Mitchell, who's a senior editor for Harper's Magazine. This is the first of a two-part series called Legislative Leftovers. We're talking about health care. We're talking about health care as part of a two-part series called Legislative Leftovers with Luke Mitchell, the senior editor for Harper's, and Ezra Klein, who writes the Economic and Domestic Policy and Lots of It blog for The Washington Post. Ezra, you pointed out that it's become hard to distinguish who wants to negotiate a deal and who just wants to kill the legislation altogether. Are there enough senators who are really willing to make a deal?
You know, I think that there are two questions there, right? One is, are there enough who are willing to make the deal, and will they be willing to make the deal at the end of August? And then the other is, what kind of deal are they willing to make? And it is important here, I think, to just remember Democrats, assuming that Kennedy and Byrd can be wheeled in on a gurney to vote, have 60 votes in the U.S. Senate, right? They don't actually theoretically need any Republicans to run this through. And so one thing that people, I think, have been very confused about is that there is a difference between filibustering this bill, which is what you would need 60 votes to beat, and voting yes on this bill, where you need 51. So you could imagine a situation in which Ben Nelson and Evan Bayh and a few other conservative Democrats say, we're not going to filibuster the bill, but we don't like it, and we're going to vote against it. You could then have 60 votes to close down a filibuster, and the bill passes with 55. So one of the questions really is not just are there enough Republicans here to make a deal, but do you want to make a deal with the Republicans, or can you extract some level of party unity simply on the question of the filibuster? And right now it's a bit of an open question.
In an interview you posted on Saturday, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham told you that Democrats need to understand that there won't be a public option anytime soon, if ever. So is that the thing that's a stumbling block for Republicans, the public option?
For Republicans, certainly. I mean, one of the things that I'm not quite sure Lindsey Graham is right about that. I think that the public option is actually a pretty popular piece of legislation, and that it's going to be in some ways hard to get a deal out of Democrats, particularly in the House, if you don't have some version of it. But you know what Graham was saying was that if you really want a bipartisan deal, then you need to then Democrats on the one hand will have to accept that, but Republicans on the other will have to accept that we need true universal coverage with a government mandate and government subsidies to help people into it. He's an advocate of the Wyden-Bennett Healthy Americans Act bill, which I think is actually a very good bill and has a number of sort of co-sponsors on both sides of the aisle, but is sort of has been judged, I think, too radical on both ends to take a center stage in this debate.
Luke, I'm sure a lot of people have no idea what that public option actually is.
The public option would allow the government itself to offer a form of insurance. It's understood as sort of the camel's nose in the tent of a single-payer plan. And it could, in fact, be that. I think that's one reason some on the left like it. Or it could actually act as the opposite of that. If the public option is captured by the insurance business, it could be a repository for poor, sick people who make terrible insurance company customers. That is something that will be resolved in the specifics of the legislation.
Now, Ezra mentioned that Ted Kennedy might be wheeled in on a gurney along with Robert Byrd. Some have noted that the absence of Ted Kennedy, who's being treated for brain cancer, has hurt the health care effort. Do you think that if he'd been there, the debate would have changed much?
He's certainly a persuasive speaker, and he's got a lot of friends in Congress. But this is not a debate about personalities. This is a debate. Basically, it's a battle over the 2010 congressional elections, and it's a battle over a division of spoils for the largest part of the American economy.
Now, Ezra, what's made the Senate negotiations so much more difficult than what happened with the House version? Is it simply that the Democratic majority in the House is bigger, or has to depend less on the support of Blue Dog Democrats?
Interestingly, the Democratic majority in the House is not bigger. The Democrats in the House have 59% of the seats, and in the Senate, 60. The difference is the filibuster. And more to the point, the sort of power that the filibuster gives to Democrats on the edge. So on the one hand, you have fewer Democrats and fewer of everybody in the Senate. And so on the other hand, you have those last couple of votes have a lot of power. I mean, if you lose 10 or 15 blue dogs in the House, well, really, who cares? You know, you've still got your majority. But if you lose 4 or 5 or 6 Democrats in the Senate and they begin to say, you know, we're not really sure, we may just hold this up, then you actually can't move forward. I mean, the problem problem here, and the problem that has always been true in healthcare, is the Senate kills large legislation on just about every issue. I mean, it is an anti-majoritarian institution that is non-representative, that now, and only in the past couple of 30 years or so, has developed a supermajority requirement. One of the things about healthcare right now is that there's a sense in which this is about healthcare, but there's a larger sense, I think, in which this is about the political system more generally and our inability to move forward on creating hard solutions to tough problems. I mean, you're going to see a very similar debate play out on climate change. And, you know, I really think that there's a question here. You know, we can see a fiscal crisis coming from healthcare. We can see a global crisis coming from climate change. And we have a political system that I think most of us would say is not going to be able to respond effectively to either one. Even if we pass healthcare reform, it isn't enough. Not the way we're doing it. We're too afraid. We're not being able to make hard decisions. And I think there's something very fundamentally unsettling here. My colleague Steve Perlstein the other day wrote a really beautiful column, and he said, you know, this is fundamentally a test of whether or not America can still function as a civil society, whether we trust ourselves and our government enough to make large changes on the problems that confront us. And, you know, I'm increasingly concerned the answer to that is simply no, that we don't trust ourselves, we don't trust each other, and we don't trust the government to do any of the things that need to be done.
But I wonder why. A listener has written in asking, don't we already have a lot of government health care? Reaching those on Medicare and veterans, they're happy with it. Do opponents think that they shouldn't have their government programs?
Well, again, this goes precisely to the problem that we face right now, which is not that there's a lack of fairly sensible solutions that can actually get the system working far better than it does now. The problem is that we can't discuss them in any kind of rational way. For example, famously now, Americans seem to believe that Medicare is not a government program. Famously, Republicans now, Newt Gingrich can go out and talk about Democrats wanting to euthanize people. This is not a discourse that has anything whatsoever to do with actual reform. It's a discourse that does, however, have a lot to do with maintaining power and access to money. The way you solve that problem is you speak sensibly about things. You talk not so much about Newt Gingrich or Sarah Palin and euthanasia. You talk about why single payer could work. You talk about how Medicare has worked over the years and what can be made to make it work better. And that's something that I think that Ezra does a good job of that we're trying to do at Harper's. It's a slow approach, but there's no real other choice.
My guests are Luke Mitchell, a senior editor for Harper's, and Ezra Klein, who writes the Economic and Domestic Policy and Lots of It blog for The Washington Post. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Ezra, this is the first bill that President Obama has tried to shepherd through Congress. Did he make a wise choice? Because did he realize this was going to be such a big problem for him?
Well, I'm not sure this is the first bill. I mean, he tried to move stimulus through and S-CHIP, and he's sort of done a variety of pieces of legislation. Certainly the biggest and most controversial. You know, you get a lot of sort of arguments right now about whether or not Obama is relying too much on Congress, you know, whether he's giving too much power to the chairman. But the thing everybody says about Clinton, me included, was that he didn't give enough power to them. And I think, again, the analogy I use here is of a wall. You have a couple people in a prison cell, and they can see, you know, freedom through the window, and, you know, they're just trying to get through this wall. And so one guy spends, you know, a year trying to bang the bed frame into it, and everybody sort of laughs and says, you know, you don't have enough power. And then the other guy says, you know, I got it. So he sort of is chipping away at it with a pen for a year. And eventually they laugh and say, you know, you need much more power than that. But the problem isn't their strategies. It's the wall. I mean, the problem is the Senate. The problem is polarization. I'm not sure there is some sort of secret combination of, you know, bully pulpiting and congressional cajoling and advertisements and grassroots organizing that Obama could have activated to move this or even a much better bill through Congress. I just think that it is incredibly hard to get anything through Congress right now. And it is, again, it's sort of a central problem that we have not had the courage as a country to face up to.
Well, Luke, hasn't President Obama's views on health care evolved a lot since he was elected to the Senate in 2004?
Well, he used to be a proponent of a single-payer approach to things, but over time he's become what I think he would probably call more realistic about what's possible. I think that's been a mistake on his part. As we've seen, the discussion in this country is not about any particular policy that Obama or any Democrat has proposed. It's about crazy made-up things. Therefore, if the conversation is going to be only about crazy made-up things, you might as well propose whatever you think the best plan is, because no one's going to talk about that anyway.
Well, the health insurance company saw a major fall in profits last year. Do you think that's made them more or less willing to make concessions?
I think it's made them more willing to do what they've been doing all along, which is try to capture the regulatory process to secure their profits. We're talking about a reform that's going to be $1 trillion over the next 10 years. That $1 trillion isn't going to you and me. It's going to the industry. They're succeeding in this fight.
The big surprise is that the AMA has endorsed the House version of the bill. And that that's the more liberal version of the bill, isn't it?
Well, I want to reject that spectrum. It's a more appealing version, but it's not especially liberal. Every version of every bill we've seen so far basically is something that in the end will benefit private health insurance by giving them more customers, by mandating that people buy their products, by making their payouts smaller, and so on. They're winning coming in, and they're winning coming out.
Ezra, early on, the White House seemed to give the outlines of what it wanted to see in the legislation and then left many of the details up to Congress. But has the White House really been leaving all that much to Congress? Hasn't there been a lot of behind-the-scenes activity?
There's been a lot of behind-the-scenes activity, and they gave some details. I mean, one interesting
the drug, for example, the deal with the drug companies.
Well, that's a little bit of a more – it's a bit more of, I think, a side issue as opposed to the fundamental structure of the legislation. But one reason they did this, it should be said, is that there's actually a tremendous amount of consensus in Democratic circles on what health care reform is going to look like. I mean, if you look back to the campaign, there were arguments between Obama and Clinton and Edwards on, you know, the individual mandate, say. But fundamentally, those plans all looked very, very similar. They look similar to plans brought out by liberal interest groups, and they look very similar to what both Baucus and, you know, Waxman, you know, with varying sort of degrees of generosity, are building in their own committees. So one of the reasons I think this happened is that everybody sort of knew what they were dealing with. And I think that, you know, when you hear people say, oh, well, you know, if only they had taken a firmer hand, we'd be looking at a better bill, and that would be really popular. I sort of wonder why people think that, right? You know, why they think that the Obama administration would have a better idea of what Congress would support than the people who are actually in Congress would, and the people who are building these bills would.
Just to be clear, I don't think it would be any more popular. It'd probably be a little less popular, but it would be a much, much better bill.
Oh, I'm not arguing to anything you said here, but one thing, the reason I don't think that is that this is the bill Obama wanted. What we're seeing here is exactly like the bill he built in the campaign. So when people say that if only the White House had come in and taken a firmer hand, I think the firmer hand would have ended with us looking at exactly this pretty much. I mean, if you go back and look at the bill he had, this is, if anything, a little bit better of a bill. Certainly what passed the House is a little bit better than what Obama was offering. It's more realistic. The public option is a bit stronger. The exchanges are a bit better. And there's an individual mandate, which you needed, and he didn't offer. So I just think that part of the reason they did it was that actually Congress followed their wishes almost to the letter.
Before the recess, the House was working on a measure that would allow the government to negotiate drug prices and demand additional rebates from drug manufacturers. But hasn't the White House been working on a deal that drug lobbyists said would block cap cost savings at $80 billion? Why is the White House more willing to cut a deal with the drug companies?
I think the question is why they feel they need to cut a deal with the drug companies in the first place. The drug companies are private providers of good that people can buy or not buy. Why the government feels that they need to offer them a legislative advantage in any process is mind-boggling to me. I understand that there's a political process that's going on, but the government holds a lot more cards than they think they do in this process.
Well, is the White House trying to drive a wedge between insurers and drug companies?
I should certainly hope so.
And it's not just between them. I mean, what they're fundamentally trying to do is trying to drive a wedge between industry and Republicans. I mean, this bill has been, you know, and to this, Luke is pretty much right. This bill has been built in such a way that you're fundamentally buying off every relevant interest group, that the pharmaceutical companies don't have to give up very much, that the insurers really don't have to give up very much. I mean, everybody's got to make some changes, but not many. And the fact that you're getting these voluntary agreements is enough to pretty much just say that these aren't really rough changes. I mean, I had this interview with Nancy Pelosi a few weeks ago, and she was angry about the pharmaceutical deal there. And she said, you know, when they're saying, we'll give you 80. Well, ha 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 ha. She said, "You know they can. You can get at least 160. You know can be at least double that." But they have sort of made a strategy here, and they've said, "All right, well, what we want to do is not have hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of industry ads going against us. We want industry to fundamentally be on board for reform because they feel comfortable with this reform. And if they don't get it, they don't know what the next time will be. They don't know if the next one will be a more populist moment, or there'll be a larger Democratic majority, or there'll be some national crisis or a default on our debt. So get them on our side now." And that has made, you know, and I think Luke is again right on this, something of a worse bill. But it has, I think, really clarified the situation here considerably, which is that what killed Clinton in 1994 and what's killing and what's hurting Obama now is not fundamentally industry opposition or industry support. It is minority and the sort of incentives minority has to make a failure out of the majority.
Does the health care bill provide an opportunity for people to get a little more money for whatever their pet project is? For example, rural hospitals want higher Medicare payments. Urban hospitals want more money for medical education and financial incentives to serve poor communities. Oncologists are demanding that scheduled cuts to Medicare payments be reversed. And there are people in Congress, I would think, that all would want to get into that little bit of pork.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, certainly any major bill that goes through Congress is going to be, in large part, a way of bringing home the bacon, which I think is a venerable part of the process. But really, the main bacon that's being brought home here is not, an agricultural research center at a hospital. It's reform that allows the insurance companies to continue as they always have, making a lot of money. And in fact, we're seeing that as the insurance companies look way on the long horizon, we're passing laws that don't allow them to make certain choices about who to insure and who not to insure. We just passed the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act that prevents them from not insuring people based on genetic conditions. We're probably going to include something in this reform that requires them to insure all kinds of people. And as that process continues, they are going to need the government to guarantee them customers down the road.
Harry Reid has promised passage of a bill by fall. Then we're going to have to see the House and the Senate negotiate in committee to come together on some major compromises. Do either of you think that we're actually going to have a bill in place by the end of the fall?
I would guess that there will be a bill.
What is that, September 23rd?
Yeah. I would say that there will be a bill. There will be a bill that is a compromise that doesn't really reform the system but does help a lot of people who don't have insurance right now at a cost that's far greater than it should be.
I think that's about exactly right, and I would just say that I think Democrats really get that if they don't get a bill, they're going to lose the next election. So one way or the other, you're going to have something. You will just simply not have the situation that the Clintons had where they lose on the bill and don't have a backup plan.
Well, with that in mind,
the question is how quickly they'll move to a backup plan.
A listener asked, why is Obama not using his network to get people out to support his plan?
People are coming out.
This weekend I got an Organizing for America email about, trying to get people to actually go to Congress people's offices, literally in Washington or where they live, and begin, pretty much yelling at the staffers there. I mean, they're really trying to activate this. But the problem is that it's not a really activated list right now. I mean, and I think you're seeing the difficulties of trying to run a grassroots organization from the White House, right? In the campaign, people were very invested. They were very involved. And they had, through a sort of a long period of getting involved, become used to participating. And now, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they're being asked to jump in again. And that's being harder, in part because Obama can't lead that with the same sort of ferocity and directness with which he once could.
That's right. It's easier to get,
because they're not used to it.
It's easy to get media coverage when you can threaten to lynch a congressman. It's much more difficult to get media coverage when you want to make a complex argument about reform.
I want to thank the two of you for participating in today's Healthcare Look as part of our Legislative Leftover series. Luke Mitchell is a senior editor for Harper's. Ezra Klein is a staff writer for The Washington Post, where he writes the Economic and Domestic Policy and Lots of It blog. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.